Chapter 3. Courtship. The brown brick office building at 6551 Loisdale Court in Springfield, Virginia, is hardly the sort of place where James Bond would make his headquarters. With tiny vertical windows, it is the plainest of structures, the lobby decorated with thin, slate-blue carpeting and cheap blondwood doors. Known as the Spring Mall Building, the structure could not be more inconspicuous or less inviting. Which is the point? For it was from this building that the CIA and the FBI recruited the first KGB officer inside the Soviet embassy in Washington. Under the CIA's charter, the agency may not exercise law enforcement or police powers, or undertake internal security functions. But that does not mean it cannot operate within the United States. Obviously, in order to operate at all, the CIA must have a headquarters in the U.S. and train people in the U.S. The CIA's charter does not specifically say the CIA may not gather intelligence in the U.S. Rather, the history of the legislation makes it clear the CIA may gather intelligence within the United States so long as the target is foreign. That understanding was codified by Executive Order 12333, which President Reagan signed on December 4, 1981. It says the CIA may operate domestically in order to collect significant foreign intelligence, so long as the effort does not involve spying on the domestic activities of Americans. The CIA's internal regulations, most of them classified, make this clearer. They say that if a CIA officer intends to recruit a U.S. citizen or enlist the cooperation of a U.S. firm, he must identify himself as being with the CIA. For years, through what used to be called the Foreign Resources Division within the Directorate of Operations, the CIA has operated within the U.S. by recruiting foreigners visiting in the U.S., diplomats of other countries, for example, or visiting scientists. The greatest percentage of these recruits who become agents or spies for the CIA are military personnel being trained in the U.S. When they return home, these agents continue to work for the CIA. As a side benefit, they may also report on foreign targets of interest. For example, what is happening within the Chinese Communist Embassy in Washington, while they are stationed in the U.S. The very existence of the Foreign Resources Division, now called a branch within a new Domestic Resources Division, is a closely guarded secret. Usually the only references in the press to domestic operations of the CIA are to what was previously called the National Collection Division, now a branch within the Domestic Resources Division. Also located within the Directorate of Operations, this component operates overtly, asking Americans who travel overseas to report on what they see once they return. During the war in the Gulf, the Domestic Collection Office obtained plans for Iraqi targets from American and other businessmen who had helped build them. The two components, the National Collection Branch and the Foreign Resources Branch, maintain separate offices in major cities throughout the country. The offices operate under commercial cover. That means the offices purport to be private companies. For example, in the 1980s, the Foreign Resources Office for the Washington area was identified only as a consulting firm in the Air Rights Building at 7101 Wisconsin Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland. Here, in a building sheathed with brown-tinted glass, the station chief, deputy station chief, and a communicator maintained their offices. In addition, three other nearby offices, also operating as national companies, targeted people from the Soviet bloc, East Asia, and the Third World. A lawyer was recruited to act as a front man for the companies. Each CIA officer in the Washington office had three aliases used in conducting his work. One as a businessman, one as an ordinary government employee, and one as a CIA official. Meetings were never conducted at the office. Rather, the CIA officers arranged to meet contacts at lunch or in other social settings. Besides the one in Washington, the CIA maintains FR stations, formerly known as bases, in such cities as Boston, New York, Chicago, St. Louis, Houston, Miami, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Seattle. The two biggest stations are in Washington, which has some 30 officers, and New York, which has nearly 40. The Domestic Resources Branch has more offices and a larger staff. Even though it operates under commercial cover, its activities are more open. Identifying themselves as CIA officers, its staff members ask American businessmen and university professors for information they pick up on their travels. By contrast, the Foreign Resources Branch recruits foreigners to become agents or spies. In deciding which foreigners to recruit, each station has a wish list. The list ranks the importance of each target country from 1 to 5. Traditionally, the Soviets have been number 1 and still are within FR. But with the end of the Cold War, the Chinese, Japanese, and Cubans were given higher priority in many overseas locations. In recruiting people, the CIA officers in the FR office go to receptions and parties where foreign diplomats may show up. They strike up conversations with them and try to gauge their susceptibility. Pretending to be employees of private companies, they invite them to lunch or dinner. Eventually, they make a pitch, offering a steady income if they agree to spy for the U.S. The amount varies with the country and the status of the individual being recruited. Typically, it is a few $100s a month. Money is seldom a motivating factor with Soviets or Communist Chinese. Rather, they agree to spy for ideological reasons or disagreements with their bosses. Each year, FR recruits 200 to 300 people as CIA agents or spies. Over the years, FR has recruited Czech, Hungarian, Polish, and other Soviet bloc diplomats as spies. During the early 1980s, roughly half of those recruited accepted money and training and then vanished once they returned home. Yet case officers and station chiefs still received credit for the recruitments. What was happening, a former operations officer said, was FR officers would recruit these guys, they would go back, and the local station couldn't find them. They would arrange to meet on the third Thursday of the month, and they wouldn't show. Or they would show up and wouldn't be cooperative. To improve performance, the CIA put a new system into effect. No one would get credit for a recruitment until the agent had produced useful intelligence or had cooperated over a period of time. If the fact that the CIA recruits spies in the U.S. sounds surprising, the idea of the CIA teaming up with the FBI to do so, given the historic relationship between the two agencies, is even more astonishing. Under the long reign of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI and the CIA were frequently at loggerheads. At one point, Hoover actually forbade FBI agents to communicate with the agency, forcing them to meet with CIA officers clandestinely. That changed dramatically when William H. Webster became FBI Director, succeeding Clarence M. Kelly. In 1980, the CIA and the FBI created a secret joint operation to recruit Soviet spies in Washington, a move that would have been unthinkable under Hoover. The operation, in the form of a squad within the FBI's Washington Metropolitan Field Office, was the idea of George Colaris, who had been chief of the CIA's counterintelligence staff, and James Nolan, the FBI's deputy assistant director in the counterintelligence division. In part, it represented an effort to overcome the historical enmity between the two agencies. Normally, the CIA recruits agents in the U.S. so they can spy overseas. It is the FBI that is charged, as part of its counterintelligence program, with developing agents to engage in counterspying within the U.S. But Nolan and Colaris, who had become friends in the course of work, decided it made sense to pool the knowledge and resources of the FBI and the CIA to recruit Soviets to work for the intelligence agencies while still stationed on American soil. Codenamed Courtship, the joint operation is designated Squad CI-11 within the FBI's Washington Metropolitan Field Office. Besides secretaries and an administrative officer, the squad consists of 9 professional employees, 5 FBI agents, and 4 CIA officers. The squad is headed by an FBI agent whose deputy is a CIA officer. Each of the CIA officers and FBI agents assigned to the squad has 3 different covers. They could pose as employees of another government agency, as employees of a private company, or as FBI or CIA officers under aliases. To back up their cover stories, they have Visa cards, social security numbers, and driver's licenses, all in false names. The credit limit on the Visa cards was only $1,000 until FR objected, and the limit was raised to $2,000. Until recently, the squad was based in the Loisdale Court building behind the Hilton Inn off Exit 57 on Interstate Route 95 in Springfield, Virginia. In contrast to the Spartan appearance of the building and its lobby, Courtship's suite was lavishly furnished with oriental rugs and screens confiscated during raids. A receptionist sat behind a glass window inside a reception area. Only the members of the squad could enter the inner offices. At the time Courtship was recruiting a KGB officer in the Soviet embassy in Washington, it was operating out of the Springfield office building, behind the sign of a consulting firm. As its name implies, the purpose of the squad is to court Soviet spies, either officers of the KGB or the GRU, the Soviet Military Intelligence Organization. Normally, when a Soviet is assigned to work in Soviet establishments in the United States for the first time, one of the FBI's counterintelligence squads is assigned to watch him. For a year, the FBI studies his activities to determine if he is an intelligence officer. If the FBI decides he is, the FBI assigns him to an appropriate counterintelligence squad for further observation and possible recruitment. Each of the 20 squads specializes in a particular intelligence service and division within that service. Even if the FBI decides he is not a spy, he is still assigned to a squad for observation. Under the rules established by the FBI and CIA, the courtship squad has first choice in picking the intelligence officers that appear most susceptible to recruitment. Once an intelligence officer is recruited by courtship, he is reassigned to the appropriate FBI squad based on his KGB or GRU affiliation. In determining which KGB officers would most likely agree to spy for the U.S., the courtship squad consults with psychologists from the CIA and the FBI and reviews all the available information about him. Each officer looks for different signs of receptivity. Some are interested in Soviets who have never been outside the Soviet Union before, who dress well, and who seem to be interested in American society. Others swear these qualities bear no relation to whether a Soviet will agree to be recruited. As a rule, the squad targets only one Soviet at a time. If the recruitment effort fails, they assign the Soviet to the appropriate FBI squad and target another individual. The squad never uses outright blackmail or other forms of coercion. It is an article of faith within the U.S. intelligence community that blackmail never works. The CIA once spent months trying to no avail to recruit a KGB officer in Southeast Asia who was believed to be a homosexual. However, a vulnerability such as cheating on an expense account or becoming involved in repeated car accidents with an embassy vehicle may be used to coax a prospective agent into cooperating. Money is one way to recruit an agent. It also contributes to compromising agents in case they later have second thoughts about cooperating. But even large sums do not work if a prospective agent does not already have misgivings or complaints about his situation. Just before he was to be sent home in 1982 after a lengthy tour in the United States, the FBI sought to recruit Dmitry I. Yakushkin, the KGB resident or station chief in Washington. For the purpose, the FBI had been authorized to offer $20 million, a reasonable figure when one considers that Yakushkin could have revealed almost every detail of the KGB's operations against the U.S. Shortly before Yakushkin was to leave for Moscow, two FBI agents approached him when he and his wife Irina were shopping at the Safeway on Wisconsin Avenue in Washington's Georgetown section. As Irina went off in another direction and Yakushkin was fondling the oranges, an FBI agent approached him. "I am a special agent of the FBI, and I wondered if I could have an opportunity to talk to you," the FBI man said. He asked Yakushkin if he would agree to meet with the special agent in charge of the Washington field office. "What is your name?" the KGB man asked. The agent gave a false name. "May I see your ID to prove you are an FBI agent?" Sheepishly, the agent showed it to Yakushkin. The KGB officer saw that the FBI agent had given a phony name. "I'm sorry, I kind of made that up," the agent said. "Yeah, I know how it is. Would there be any way to arrange an appointment for our SAC, special agent in charge, to speak to you?" the agent persisted. "Sure, have him come by the embassy any time," Yakushkin said, smiling. "Well, actually, I was hoping for a less formal environment, if that would be okay." "I don't really think I'd be interested in that." It was clear the conversation was going nowhere, so the agent decided to take a chance and make the offer on the spot. He offered Yakushkin $20 million to work for the U.S. "Young man, I appreciate the offer," Yakushkin said. "If I were 20 years younger, I'd give it serious consideration." "It was nice meeting you," the KGB officer said, then adjusted his beret and walked off toward the meat section to find his wife. It was a CIA officer assigned to the Foreign Resources Branch who first spotted the KGB officer later recruited by courtship in late 1982. The man was attending a professional conference in Washington. To the CIA officer, he seemed susceptible to recruitment. The CIA officer had a hunch that the man was more interested in American life than other KGB officers. For one thing, he spoke English better than others. He was also more eager to please the Americans he met than other Soviets. All reports of contacts by FR officers are seen by courtship, which decided to single him out for recruitment. Pretending to be a private consultant, a member of the courtship squad befriended the KGB officer, taking him to dinner and letting him know that he had access to military secrets. Once satisfied that the man would likely agree to work for the American side, the courtship officer revealed his true affiliation. For a number of years, squad members met with the KGB officer at least once a week. The meetings with the KGB officer were alternately held in two safe houses, both apartments in the Washington area. To give the KGB officer an alibi for taking time away from his regular duties, the squad passed him information obtained from a man who was in the defense consulting business. Acting as a double agent, the man pretended to work for the Soviets, but really was working for courtship. Occasionally, the squad members let the KGB officer meet with the man himself. Anything the man told the KGB officer or the Soviets was cleared by the U.S. government first. The squad members instructed the KGB officer to engage in elaborate dry cleaning, driving into dead ends, speeding up to 70 miles per hour, then slowing to 20 miles per hour, before he met with them. They wanted to make sure he was not being followed. Because it is a precaution the man should have taken anyway in the normal course of his spy work, the dry cleaning would not raise any suspicions if the Soviets noticed it. Even before they asked him for any information, the squad members asked the KGB officer what he had been doing for the past several hours. They wanted to make sure he had protected himself. The next order of business was to agree on the location for the next meeting, one of the two safe houses rented just for meeting with the KGB man. Then the squad members debriefed him on the latest developments within the embassy and the KGB's plans. Without his knowledge, the squad members videotaped the sessions, which lasted an hour to an hour and a half. To make sure he was genuine, the squad members asked the KGB officer a series of questions, the answers to which they already knew. He passed with flying colors. It was the first recruitment of a KGB officer from the Soviet embassy in Washington. In the view of CIA and FBI officials, that one recruitment alone justified the existence of courtship. The courtship squad paid the KGB officer $200 for each meeting, plus $1,000 a month placed directly in a special bank account in his name. Because the squad members were worried that the man would call attention to himself, they asked him near the beginning of each meeting what he had done with the money he'd previously received. Only a few months after the man had been recruited, an FBI squad succeeded in recruiting a second KGB officer within the embassy. Besides this source, the FBI had previously recruited a KGB officer assigned to the Soviet United Nations delegation in New York. With the help of the CIA, the FBI had also recruited another KGB officer assigned to the Soviet consulate in San Francisco. However, the two recruitments in Washington were by far the most important. The KGB man recruited by courtship provided the CIA and FBI with a roadmap to how the KGB worked in Washington. He gave away identities and duties of KGB and GRU officers, biographical data on Soviet diplomats, and plans for recruiting Americans as spies. The KGB officer knew the locations of listening devices the KGB had planted and the details of how other electronic devices operated. For example, he revealed that the KGB supplies its agents with devices that propel themselves underwater. When they surface, they send coded messages in bursts to satellites for transmission to Moscow. They thus conceal the location of the agent using the transmitter. From the KGB officer, the CIA and FBI learned how the KGB protects itself just before its officers pick up classified documents from dead drops in tree stumps in the Washington area. A KGB officer drives around the area with a monitor that picks up FBI radio transmissions. If everything is safe, he switches on a green light visible through his windshield. If FBI transmissions are detected, he switches on a red light and the pickup is called off. The KGB officer revealed how the Soviets intercepted microwave calls to and from U.S. government offices from a secret listening post at Mount Alto, their new compound in Washington. Thanks to gross bureaucratic ineptitude, the State Department had allowed the Soviets to build the compound on the second highest elevation in Washington. They were trying to isolate CIA recruiting offices, an American intelligence officer said. They intercepted a call from someone in North Carolina who was calling a recruiting office. If the Soviets got their names and they showed up somewhere, they would conclude they are CIA. The KGB officer said the Soviets targeted Langley, the White House, and State, but he never knew of anything good that came out. According to the KGB officer, the KGB supplies its officers with a wish list of technology or other information it would like to obtain. The list ranges from plans for the Strategic Defense Initiative, known as Star Wars, to inside information on who would most likely win the next presidential election. The KGB officer replayed these lists to the courtship squad members. In addition, when he returned to Moscow periodically, the officer reported back on the latest changes in the leadership of the Soviet intelligence organization and the KGB's plans worldwide. At one point, the KGB man handed over copies of the formal plans of the KGB in Washington for the next year, including specific plans to sow disinformation by distributing fraudulent documents. As an example of how the KGB worked, the officer related that KGB headquarters, known as the Center, periodically sent a tasking document that instructed each officer to mention the same piece of information to every American with whom they met. The information might relate to Soviet plans for arms reduction talks, for example, or how many missiles the Soviets had. So you had 100 guys saying the same sentence. Everyone agrees it must be true. In fact, it's a lie, the KGB officer involved in the operation said. From the officer's account, the squad gathered that the KGB was not having quite as much success as the FBI and CIA had thought. Often, KGB officers sent reports to Moscow claiming to have obtained secret information that they actually got from the newspapers. One guy wrote a 10-page report on a conversation he allegedly had with Caspar Weinberger when he was Secretary of Defense, a former officer involved in the operation said. Actually, all he did was shake his hand in a receiving line. Understandably, there was much that the KGB man did not have access to. For example, he did not know of any recruitments of Americans in Washington, even though former Navy warrant officer John A. Walker, Jr. was then working for the Soviets there. But the information he did provide enabled the CIA and FBI to anticipate KGB moves and, where possible, counteract the KGB's schemes. He also identified Americans who were working for the Soviets, but not necessarily providing them with classified information that would result in prosecution for espionage. It was a counterintelligence officer's dream to be able to find out from the inside what the opposition was planning to do before it did it. We knew everything, said an individual who read the material from the debriefings. Stuff wouldn't happen unless we knew about it. The fact that the recruitment occurred in Washington, where numerous sensitive agencies are prime KGB targets, made it even more important. The recruitment is but one of hundreds of similar CIA successes, most of them still secret. In some cases, KGB officers recruited by the CIA have retired in place without their countries ever knowing that for most of their careers they were traitors. Nearly all of them were recruited not in Washington, but in the CIA's stations overseas. Chapter 4. Falling in Love. The CIA has stations in 130 countries. They range in size from one-person stations in some African countries to 60-person posts, including support employees, in such cities as Tokyo and Rome. About 15% of the CIA's employees are stationed overseas. Depending on their size, CIA stations may have a chief of support, a finance officer, a communications officer, a logistics officer, and a personnel officer. Large stations may have branches that focus on internal political affairs, Soviet matters, terrorism, narcotics, nuclear weapons, and liaison with local intelligence and internal security services. Through liaison, the CIA obtains information on people of interest to the agency. In exchange, the CIA usually gives the host country information it wants, perhaps the location of a fugitive. Besides providing useful intelligence, the CIA may supply the host intelligence service with funds to help it combat a local communist or terrorist problem. But the CIA plays it both ways. The agency recruits members of the local intelligence service to find out what that country is trying to do to penetrate or thwart the CIA, and to obtain other information the local security services do not want to share with the CIA. Often, the CIA's liaison with local services is a pretext to enable CIA officers to get close to individuals in the local services and recruit them. In a reversal of that, Ghana recruited Sharon M. Scranage, a CIA support employee, to find out what the agency was doing in that country. The primary role of the stations is to recruit agents to tell the CIA what the host government is doing and to report on the activities of diplomats from other countries, such as the Soviet Union or Communist China, that are of interest to the CIA. Depending on how sensitive he or she is, a CIA officer may choose to receive information from an agent over lunch or in microfilm left in dead drops in tree stumps or holes in telephone poles. To further protect the agent, a seemingly chance encounter known as a brush pass may be arranged. The agent passes documents or film to a CIA officer inside a briefcase or some other article as they pass each other. Coded transmissions by radio or by satellite are commonly used. Laser beams aimed at office buildings are used to carry messages as well. The only way a laser communication can be intercepted is if a receiver is placed in the path of the laser beam. Since most have official cover, CIA officers must perform their normal State Department or military duties on weekdays and then carry out CIA operations evenings and weekends. If you wanted to know who was CIA, look at the embassy sign-in log on Sunday. With the possible exception of the ambassador, only CIA people showed up on Sunday, Herbert F. Saunders, a former CIA officer, said. The CIA officers are paid through the State Department or military, with funds secretly provided by the CIA. If a letter is sent to an undercover officer at Langley, it is returned. Likewise, the CIA switchboard operator, if asked, would say there is no listing for the employee. A CIA officer may fill any State Department position overseas except that of ambassador or deputy chief of mission, the second in command at an embassy. Thus, when former CIA Director Richard Helms became ambassador to Iran, he could not serve as a CIA officer. In practice, the rank of counselor, used for higher-ranking diplomats who are often in charge of a section, is never used either. CIA officers recruit agents the same way salesmen or lawyers go looking for business or journalists go looking for sources. If an officer in Mexico City, for example, is interested in recruiting a military officer, he might ask for recommendations from the U.S. military attachés stationed at the embassy, attend functions and conferences where military personnel show up, go to bars where they might hang out, and take advantage of other opportunities to meet the sort of person he is after. If an officer is interested in recruiting diplomats, he might attend diplomatic functions or go to diplomatic clubs, many of which were started by the CIA for that purpose. Once the officer has spotted a likely prospect, he cables CIA headquarters for traces, a search of CIA files for information on the person. Most of the information is stored in computers. He may also call for help from the Office of Technical Service, which provides the tools of the spy trade, such as radio transmitters and secret writing papers. CIA headquarters may provide information on the individual's interests, such as tennis, and the CIA officer may suggest that they play. Or the CIA officer may learn that the prospect has a health problem. In the case of a key Soviet ambassador in Africa, CIA officer Howard Bain knew that he had a heart problem. In the days when the machines were still new, Bain arranged to lend him an EKG machine. When it came time to pick up the machine, Bain picked it up himself. Then Bain made his pitch. He showed the ambassador a Time magazine article about some recent developments in treating heart problems in the U.S. "We could arrange for you to have all of this," he said. "Nobody would know about it." In this case, the pitch didn't work, but often it does. After the CIA officer has struck up a friendship, he usually offers money to become a CIA agent and spy for the U.S. After each meeting with a developmental, an individual targeted for recruitment, or an agent already recruited, The CIA officer writes a contact report. It says where and when the meeting took place, whether any money was exchanged, whether documents were received, and what was discussed. Any security problems are also noted. A reports officer in the station decides if the contact report is worth sending to Washington. If the case officer believes he has learned valuable intelligence that should be relayed to Washington, he writes it up as an intelligence report. The reports officer decides how it is to be sent and to whom. When transmitted to Washington, the report has two parts. The first page includes the cryptonym of the source and is for internal CIA use only. Depending on the information it conveys, the rest of the report is sent to such other agencies as State, the FBI, or NSA within the intelligence community. It gives a general idea of the source of the information and an indication of his reliability. If the information in the report is extremely sensitive, the general description may be altered to further conceal the source. The real name of the agent is kept at the Mexico City station in a safe. Next to the agent's name is a number. Another safe contains a list that links each number to a cryptonym. To find out the real name behind a cryptonym, an officer in Mexico City would have to have the combinations to both safes and match both lists, or he would have to obtain it from the agent's case officer. Headquarters has his real name as well. Every report from Mexico City and each of the CIA's 129 other stations carries an addressee line that gives its destination, followed by a slug line. The slug line directs the way the report is to be disseminated within the CIA and to outside agencies. One code means that the report should not be disseminated to other agencies without first consulting the division responsible for that area of the world, in this case, Latin America. In nearly all cases, the material is transmitted electronically and stored in computers. Each communication has a designated level of importance. The most important level is critic, followed by flash, immediate, priority, and routine. The first two designations, while rarely used, give a cable precedence over other cables and require immediate transmittal. Most intelligence reports go to the Directorate of Intelligence, which prepares estimates and other memos through the National Intelligence Council on the likely shape of future events in the world, the possibility that a given country will develop nuclear weapons, or that Iraq will invade Kuwait. These go to the President, often in the President's daily brief. The value of the reports from the stations is later graded by a report staff within the appropriate area division at headquarters. In some cases, the grades are influenced by reactions of other agencies, such as State or Defense, that read the reports as well. 20 is the best, and 10 is very good. A -5 means it should never have been sent. At the end of the month, each station gets a score. The more reports with high grades, the better the score for the station. Most operations officers think the average grades are meaningless. The evaluation and plan staff within the Directorate of Operations assesses the effectiveness of the operations, keeps track of the money for budgeting purposes, and tries to assign dollar values to the information obtained after consulting with those who use it. Meanwhile, an elaborate financial accounting system keeps track of the money being spent by each station. The CIA has a rigid system of financial controls that has made theft and fraud rare. The most common form of fraud is when CIA officers claim they have paid a local agent and actually kept the money themselves. While agents are required to sign receipts, it is easy to forge such documents. Yet CIA officers in Vietnam routinely paid out $100,000 in cash each month to local officials to distribute to their men, and there were few allegations of internal theft. I think that the CIA has the tightest control over every dollar spent of any government agency, Dr. John M. Clark, a former comptroller and associate deputy director of the CIA, said. While attending the Harvard Advanced Management Program, I had occasion to compare the financial practices of 50 of America's largest corporations and financial firms. None had tighter controls than the CIA. That isn't to say an agent in the field never stole any money. The auditors in the finance department uncovered fraud or theft perhaps a dozen times a year. Once in a while, there was a large one. CIA is by no means a rogue elephant, Whipple, a former CIA officer who is executive director of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, said. There isn't anything independent about the CIA. We are asked to do these things under legal authority. Everything we do is under strict controls. Everything we spend has closer controls on it than in any other element of the government. Occasionally, an officer claims he has obtained information from agents who do not exist. Often, this is uncovered when the officer is sent to another station. His replacement expects to be introduced to the agent and finds he has vanished. Or if he meets with him, the agent appears to know nothing about any secret arrangement with the CIA. It's a problem in rare cases, a former operations officer said. You replace somebody, he says, here are my agents, and the guy says, what do you mean? I never agreed to do that. What do you mean you want me to be a spy? Eventually, deceptions like these catch up with officers and they are fired. There's a perception from the outside that CIA case officers or operations officers are loose cannons, free to operate with little or no supervision, former CIA officer Saunders said. In reality, there are a multitude of checks and balances. If nobody's heard from you for 8 hours, you'd better have an explanation when you surface. This is where I've been and this is what I've been doing. When you undertake a covert or political action, you never do it without authority from Washington, former CIA officer Whipple said. I don't know of any case where any of us undertook a covert action we were not ordered to do. As a rule, there is a degree of friction between State Department and CIA officers assigned to a post. The CIA officers look at State Department officers as soft-headed errand boys. The State Department looks at CIA officers as bumbling troublemakers. You need intellectuals on the DI, Directorate of Intelligence, side. You need scientists. But the agency is not about intellectuals. The agency is about hard-nosed covert operators, a former operations officer said. That's why the State Department doesn't get along very well with the agency. They think the CIA is full of uncultured thugs. The CIA thinks the State Department is all pussies. And they are, most of them. They'll never be able to work in great harmony. In part, the frictions stem from the fact that the two agencies have different roles. The State Department guys are expected to talk to people at their level in the host government. They take at face value what they are told, a former operations officer said. The CIA, on the other hand, recruits agents who will obtain classified information or reveal confidential conversations. They are quizzed over and over again to make sure they are telling the truth. The name of the game is getting agents who tell you what people are doing, he said. The State Department is paid to hang out at receptions and ask diplomats, what are you doing these days? A covert agent is a backup. The diplomat says one thing and the covert agent says bullshit. They're doing the opposite. For their part, diplomats insist the information they pick up is often more valuable than what the CIA learns because it is attributable to responsible government officials. They often look down their noses at CIA officers. They, CIA officers, were not of the same caliber as we were, a former U.S. Consul General in Leningrad said. To be a Foreign Service officer, you practically have to be a Ph.D., and the exams were rigorous. The same was not true of other agencies. Frequently, people who couldn't get into Foreign Service went into the others. I was offered a job by the CIA at 25% more salary, but I wasn't interested. Problems develop when the CIA and the State Department both wind up dealing with the same individual, or when an ambassador wants to know everything the CIA is doing. Some ambassadors think they have a right to know who the CIA's agents are in his country. They do not, and often they have to be told that by state. Once in a while you recruit somebody who may be a contact of someone in the embassy. That's when you run into trouble, a former CIA officer said. There's no reason ever to tell anyone, except maybe the ambassador or deputy chief of mission, this is our agent. There are always some jealousies because of the usually incorrect assumption that because you are CIA, you have extra privileges, such as better housing, the former CIA officer said. That somehow you get more than they do, which isn't the case at all. This is usually based on the belief that the CIA doesn't pay for what it gets, and is thus a drain on the embassy's budget. In fact, the CIA provides state with more than enough money to pay for each of its officers overseas. State comes out ahead, but it remains a source of friction. As in any organization, there is always some friction between headquarters and the field. In every government agency, and especially in the CIA, there is continuing competition, and perhaps a touch of resentment, between headquarters and field personnel, Saunders said. The field officer thinks that headquarters is staffed by idiots who do nothing but attend meetings and don't understand squat. The headquarters guy thinks the field person is narrow. The ironic thing is that when they switch places, as inevitably they will both conclude that they have now entered the big time, where they have all the action and all the answers. It, the Directorate of Operations, is a fraternity, William Colby said. People who work closely together with a sense of discipline. There are mutual loyalties. When you live in a station overseas, there is a tendency for the families to stay together. While the CIA moved under William Webster to hire and promote more women and minorities, the Directorate of Operations remains a backwater. Many older operations officers think women cannot relate properly to males in Latin America or the Middle East, a similar prejudice that existed, until recently, about female police officers. There has never been a female division chief and only a few female station chiefs in the CIA. They say there are certain countries where you can't operate. For example, how can a woman operate in the Middle East? Robert R. Simmons, a former CIA officer, said. Sometimes some of the best officers there have been women. In some cases, it may make it easier to go against what people expect in an area. A female officer may have a reason for being there. You can hold hands. He, an agent, can give you flowers. Inside is a secret message. You can kiss him on the cheek and put something in his pocket. You can go together and not draw attention. Because of the stress of working undercover, marriages between CIA operations officers are common. You can tell your wife that you work for the CIA, Saunders said. You can say that you're going to Singapore on a delicate operational assignment, but you don't add that you're going to tap so-and-so's telephone. The security constraints sometimes have the effect of encouraging marriage among CIA people. There are many husband and wife teams in the CIA. A spouse who works or formerly worked for the agency is more likely to be sensitive to the security requirements and the stress associated with the work. He or she won't ask what you're doing and won't be offended if you don't offer the information. If both spouses are CIA officers, things are a little easier. While in theory they should not talk about sensitive operational matters unless they are both assigned to the same operation, in practice they usually wind up freely talking about their daily activities. For the most part, the job of a CIA operations officer is not as dangerous as that of a police officer. Most CIA officers operate under diplomatic immunity, and most governments do not want to risk retaliation against their own intelligence officers by harming a CIA officer. Yet a number of CIA officers have been killed in the line of duty, 53 at last count. Richard Welch, the CIA station chief in Athens, was one of the more well-known casualties. On November 25, 1975, the English-language Athens News published his name and home address. His name had first appeared in 1967 in the East German publication Who's Who in the CIA. Other publications, such as Counterspy, later listed him as well. The Athens publication urged action against Welch and other CIA officers. On December 23, 1975, Welch was shot to death on his doorstep in Athens. Because the more recent listing had been in Counterspy, many CIA officers blamed the publication for Welch's death. However, some of the CIA officers assigned to Athens at the time said Welch's identity and his home address were well known before they were published. He was living in a house that had been occupied by his predecessor, one of the officers assigned to Athens said. It was careless. You get comfortable. The climate is benign. It was convenient. He didn't have to go looking for a house. Everybody knows the chief of station. You can't do your job as chief of station if they don't know. On March 16, 1984, William Buckley, the CIA station chief in Beirut, was kidnapped. On June 3, 1985, he died in captivity after being brutally tortured. Despite claims that morale has suffered since the Church Committee hearings, most operations officers say their mood depends more on what they are doing than who heads the agency or what investigations are going on. Morale is about the same, said a recently retired operations officer who was with the agency for several decades. Everything depends on who you work for. Maybe you're working for a gem, but the one above him is a son of a bitch. Any station overseas is happy if it's successful and knows it's successful. Any organization becomes more bureaucratic. Now they standardize the car for each defector. They're not taking into account the fact one is more valuable to you. That's bureaucracy at work. For officers who perform well, the CIA provides monetary awards and intelligence medals, along with promotions. The most prized officers are those who can recruit almost anyone, yet they are not necessarily good managers. Many of the best spies do not want to work in headquarters. If a CIA officer recruits a lot, it doesn't mean he is a good leader, a former CIA officer said. You have very good case officers who can recruit a tree, but they may not be chief of station material. Sometimes you find people who say they only want to be case officers, but most want more power. You often don't know if he can recruit. Somebody who can be recruited by one person can't be by another, the former officer said. Some people can be recruited by anybody. That person may see CIA and begin imagining money. Others are not interested in money but feel they can't do much in their own system, and so they try the CIA as a way of trying to change their own government. Usually, CIA officers woo potential agents for several weeks or months before they make a pitch. The KGB, on the other hand, tends to be more patient and sometimes works on developing a relationship for years before making a move. The KGB also tends to focus on people who can reveal specific secrets, rather than recruiting anyone with access to sensitive information. The major difference is the KGB, by nature of the control it exerts, is very persistent, a former CIA officer said. They will say, "That's the target, penetrate it." They won't let go. Quite often you'll look at something and say, "There's no way I'm going to get anything on this, I'm going to do something else." In that sense, they are probably better organized. They tell them step by step what to do. The KGB also does its homework better. Americans, the former officer said, will go to a cocktail party and start something. The Soviets will say, "That guy is of interest, find out everything you can and approach him." They go about it differently. They do their homework before meeting him. When they decide to go after him, they know he's of interest. I think by nature we are more impatient than other people, the former officer said. The recruitment process, if done classically and well, should take a long time. If it's done in 3 sessions, he may not be worth a lot, and he's probably not yours anyway. It should take a long time for assessment and vetting. On the other hand, the CIA has the natural advantage of representing America. KGB officers are far more likely to want to work for the U.S. than the other way around. In the area of human spying, both the CIA and KGB have scored tremendous coups against each other. A lot of people recruit themselves, a former officer said. A lot of people walk in. One of the problems you run into throughout the agency is quantity versus quality. Everyone preaches quality, but most of the time you get quantity, a former operations officer said. Numbers have always been important. It's competition. They keep track. They count. What happened? You only got 46 reports from officers in one station this month. That was how careers were measured and made, by the numbers, Tom Gilligan, another former CIA operations officer, said in his book CIA Life. To expand their own empires, some officers at headquarters constantly ask for more information about trivial subjects. The more information they obtain, the more they can justify requests for larger budgets. A lot of it is information for information's sake, a former officer said. There are all sorts of little men sitting around, and their job is to keep track of iron ore production in Brazil. In September, station chiefs write progress reports about the previous fiscal year and outline their budget needs for the next fiscal year. A shorter interim report is also prepared in March. The reports include a listing of each asset or agent by cryptonym. As the report is forwarded up the chain of command, the cryptonyms are deleted and are replaced by aggregate numbers to further conceal identities. What you want to do basically is to show that you did better in the last 6 months than the previous 6, a former operations officer said. If you are a new station chief or section chief, you want to show you did better than the last one. So you show you recruited X number of agents and got rid of X number of bad ones. In the end, he said, quality is not taken into account as much as it should be. One good agent is not necessarily given more weight than a mediocre one. One of the gravest problems confronting the CIA is the possibility that agents may in fact be double agents, meaning they work for the other side. This happened in Cuba, where nearly all the agents recruited by the CIA back to the early 1960s were found to be plants taking instructions from Cuban Premier Fidel Castro. It was not until Juan Antonio Meñer Rodriguez, who had worked for both Cuban intelligence and counterintelligence, defected in 1987 that the CIA began to learn of the deception. The real shock came a year later when Major Florentino Aspiaga Lombard, who also had worked in Cuban intelligence, defected. He had far more detail than Rodriguez and identified as doubles 38 Cuban agents working for the CIA, practically all of the agency's complement at the time. Nearly all of the agents had taken polygraph tests and most had passed. The test results of many of the other agents were deemed inconclusive, meaning there was not sufficient evidence to show they were lying. The revelation sent shockwaves through the CIA and particularly the Latin American division, which handles Cuba. Some could point to warnings they had previously made. For example, as early as 1976, the CIA's counterintelligence staff expressed concern that some Cubans on the CIA's payroll might be double agents. Their information was superficial and generally unhelpful. They also seemed to know too much about the operations of the CIA's Madrid station, the hub for operations against Cuba over the years. This was an indication that at least some operations had been compromised or were under Cuban control. The warnings were not heeded. According to Rodriguez, the Cuban agents had all received extensive training in beating the polygraph. They were told that polygraph tests do not work, and that if the agents failed the tests, they could always convince CIA operations officers that there was something wrong with the machine. As a result, most did not show any signs of increased tension, interpreted as deception, when they lied. Rodriguez said the problem was that the American CIA officers who debriefed the Cubans were not themselves Cubans and did not understand their culture enough to interrogate them effectively. "The polygraph is a big mistake," Rodriguez said. "We in Cuban intelligence get Chinese to recruit Chinese. We are not arrogant. They, the CIA, should use Cubans. If not, you will not detect double agents." Rodriguez compared the CIA's mistakes to its decision to mount the Bay of Pigs invasion. "They didn't understand Cubans. Only a crazy would have thought in 1961 that the people would have gone against Fidel," Rodriguez said. A former CIA operations officer familiar with what happened agreed. "The relationship develops between the source and case officer," he explained. "There's a tendency to try to work out problems with the source. The Cubans knew this and told the agents that if they have a problem with a polygraph, appeal to the case agent. Don't get upset over this thing. Say you were harassed. After all, you gave them good information. There's something wrong with the polygraph." The CIA's emphasis on quantity over quality also played a role. "You want your agent to get through the polygraph successfully because you don't want the hassle of trying to establish by other means he is okay," a former operations officer said. "In general, it's not uncommon for a case officer to fall in love with an agent," former CIA officer Saunders said. "Whenever a special bond develops, as it must, between case officer and agent, there is some unique chemistry." If the agent turns out to be bad, a double or a fabricator, the officer may not want to believe it. "It's like a husband coming home at 3 a.m. and saying he was out selling encyclopedias," Saunders said. "His wife wants to believe him so badly that she does. A prudent case officer, however, is constantly vetting, checking, always cynical, often asking questions to which he already knows the answer. He doesn't trust easily, and if he doesn't pay attention, he may pay a price." The result of the Cuban deception was that the CIA wasted a lot of time and money and was not able to get the information it really wanted. Much of the information given to the CIA by the double agents was true, but not particularly damaging to Cuba. They, the Cubans, said, "Tell them anything they want to know." It wasn't that it was bad information. It was true and did not cause great policy errors to be made, according to a former operations officer familiar with the CIA's analysis of what happened. After Aspiaga's defection was publicized, Cuban television aired a series that exposed many of the CIA's operations on the island over the years. The program showed CIA operations officers picking up documents left for them by double agents in a variety of out-of-the-way places, dropping off sophisticated communications equipment for their agents, and meetings with agents in foreign countries to give them instructions. While some of the American diplomats the program claimed were CIA officers were not in the agency, most of them were. Some of the wilder schemes being discussed by CIA officers, such as substituting flimsy tanks to store ammonia so that the chemical would leak out and destroy crops, were presented as current plans but had actually been discarded by 1964. Richard F. Stoltz was the CIA's deputy director for open actions when the double agents were exposed. A respected CIA veteran, Stoltz had served in Rome, Moscow, Munich, Istanbul, Belgrade, and London, and had been chief of the Soviet East Europe Division. He told his officers that Cuba was able to fool the CIA with phony agents because of enormous pressure from the White House and from within the CIA to recruit. In addition, he blamed ethnic egotism, saying that the ability of Latinos had been underestimated. Finally, he blamed over-reliance on the polygraph, pointing out that polygraphy is an art, not a science. During Stoltz's tenure, the CIA began weeding out unproductive agents worldwide in an effort to improve quality and cut costs. As the Cold War began to wind down, the CIA began concentrating even more than before on uncovering plans to develop nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons, one of the CIA's traditional and most important roles. Once evidence of these weapons is uncovered, the U.S. government can use diplomatic pressure, trade sanctions, or other economic weapons to halt the weapons programs. For example, in 1988, Taiwan had been working on a secret installation that could have been used to obtain plutonium, a main ingredient in the production of nuclear weapons. The effort to build an installation capable of extracting plutonium violated Taiwan's secret commitments to the United States that it would undertake no research for developing atomic weapons. Moreover, the Communist Chinese had warned that if Taiwan were to develop a nuclear weapon, they would invade the island. As the work progressed, the CIA recruited Colonel Chang Hsien-ya, a scientist working on the project, and eventually he defected to the U.S. Based on his information, the State Department successfully applied pressure on the Taiwanese in 1988 to dismantle the operation. While there are five declared nuclear powers, a number of other countries have the atomic bomb and refuse to acknowledge it. Several countries either possess a nuclear device or can fabricate one on short notice, William Webster has said. Others are developing key nuclear technology that could later be used for a nuclear explosive, should the decision be made to do so. And there are still other countries which are in the early stages of nuclear technology research and development. In addition, the CIA tracks development of ballistic missiles. According to Webster, at least 15 developing nations could be producing their own ballistic missiles by the year 2000. Even the possibility of life on other planets has been considered by the CIA to be within its purview. When he was CIA director, Walter Bedell Smith authorized a CIA study of unidentified flying objects, declaring that they have possible implications for our national security. Other intelligence gathered by the CIA helps the U.S. to foresee coming events or to gain an advantage in trade or arms talks. The CIA is perennially interested in the health of foreign leaders. When they visit the U.S., the CIA has arranged to obtain samples of their feces, hair, and other bodily fluids so they can be analyzed back at Langley for health problems. Kim Il-sung, the aging strongman in North Korea, has a growth on his neck that has never appeared in photographs. The CIA arranged to have an agent report firsthand on its appearance. It was benign. The CIA has always tried to obtain the negotiating positions of other countries before arms talks or trade talks begin. Stations plant bugging devices in hotel rooms or tap telephones so that the State Department will know what it is facing before negotiations begin. Like the problem of weapons proliferation, economic matters have been given higher priority by the CIA since the end of the Cold War. The CIA tries, for example, to find out overseas what kinds of computers the Japanese are developing. For years, the CIA had an official in the entourage of the Prime Minister of Japan on its payroll. Armed with inside information on what Japan's negotiating position will be on, say, imports, the State Department can make more informed counterproposals. It is something like being able to eavesdrop on a seller and his broker when negotiating to buy a house. When the Japanese Prime Minister is here to see the President or Secretary of State, they'd like to know what he is going to talk about, a former operations officer said. While the CIA cannot be in the position of handing over commercial secrets to selected American companies, it can pass the information along to the Commerce Department so that it can issue broad guidance to all companies. For example, the Commerce Department might issue an advisory on the direction of the Japanese computer industry. But what happens when finding out what the other side is doing is not enough, when the U.S. government wants to take a more active role? That is when covert action is used, a term that covers any clandestine means to influence or overthrow a foreign power, leader, or political party.